United Lodge of Theosophists, Bangalore, welcomes you to today's short talk on the subject God, Law and Nature. Now let us prepare our minds for today's subject by dwelling upon a short devotional reading from the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 7. Devotion by means of spiritual discernment. A very appropriate devotional reading, because deep contemplation upon this particular chapter, the 7th chapter of the Gita, explains this or gives us insight into this topic which we want to discuss today, which is God, Law and Nature. The idea of God is a very important idea in everyone's life, because what we hold as to what is God, what is its relation to mankind, and the very idea of divinity itself has a very practical bearing upon our daily life, our actions, our outlook on life, and the way we live our life. And there have been cases where politicians have engaged in unlawful war against another nations and have proclaimed that they were inspired by God to wage a war against such and such a nation. And historically we have seen many crimes committed in the name of religion, in the name of God. Religious fanaticism has seen no bound, for example in the case of the crusades that happened and the conquest of the Islamic rulers, and so on and so forth. So the idea of God is a very strong and a very important idea, and it has a very practical bearing upon individual life and the very moral character of the society, the kind of ethics that we hold in our life. All this have a practical bearing on the idea of God that we hold in our mind. And we find that even science today is in the quest of what the media call as the God particle. They are trying to find that one primary fundamental building block on which the whole structure of the cosmos, the whole structure of the universe rests, the one primary particle, as they call it, the God particle. And whatever religion that we consider, whatever philosophies that we study, it would invariably, or rather most of the times, have reference to the idea of God and its relation to mankind. So usually the question is asked, do you believe in God? So this depends, the answer depends on what is meant by this idea of God. What do you mean when you ask God, do you believe in God, when this question is asked, what is meant by God here? Because every one of us have their own conceptions of God. Every one of us have our own understanding of the God idea. So the questions that are there before us are, does any such thing or a being or a principle such as God exist? And if it does, what is it? What is its implications upon our daily life? And if it does exist, how do we know it? These are some questions that arise before us. So let's consider these in the course of our discussion today. If we consider the Upanishads, we find that the idea of deity or God is seen as an infinite, boundless principle, not a person, not a being, but a principle which pervades the whole of the cosmos. In fact, we will take up a few verses from the Gita and see what is the idea of God that is reflected there. In the case of Mohammedanism, we find Allah is mentioned. For the Christians, there is the Father in heaven. And the Sikhs mention the Ek Omkar, or the one sound, the one word, which is reflected in all beings. And various philosophies mention or explain their ideas of deity in different manners. Different characteristics are given, different explanations are given. But though apparently there is a lot of difference among the idea of God which is projected among different religions like the Islam or the Hindu Vedic or the Sikh religion, the Zoroastrianism, or any religion that you take, but fundamentally they all represent, they all speak of one and the same idea of God. Definitely a human error has accumulated over a period of time, and the message of the teachers, the teachings of the teachers who came, have been distorted beyond any recognition, and many manipulations, priestly manipulations, have been done to scriptures and so on and so forth. But a comparative study of religion shows us that at the core of all religions, they all speak of the one and the same idea of God. Even many men of science intuit that there must be one primary source, one single origin of all the force, of all the power, of all the intelligence that we see in the workings of nature. For example, we have the example of Galileo, who we studied in the ICs, was a student of the Pythagorean teachings. And what about the case of Bruno? Bruno was a Pythagorean. And even our contemporary men of science, there are many of them who intuit that there must be something beyond matter. There is some intelligence beyond matter, beyond the workings of matter. But very logically, the men of science reject the idea of any kind of personal God, any kind of being who sits somewhere and controls the universe, who sits somewhere and manipulates the universe. They very logically reject such idea, and it is very logical and philosophical. The problem with the idea of having a personal God, a being, a person who sits somewhere and who controls the mechanisms, the processes, the workings of nature and of human life, is that it is very illogical, and it doesn't explain many, many, many things. For example, we find that space is infinite. There is no bound there is no boundary for space. And if a space is infinite, how can a being, and when we say a being, a person, is necessarily limited by space and time, finite. So how can somebody who is finite create or cause to create something which is infinite? And secondly, if we look at condition of the world, there is preeminently a wave of sorrow which we find among humankind. So if there is such a God who is very merciful, who is very kind, who is very considerate, then why is there so much sorrow in the world? Why is there so much suffering in the world? What is the reason for so much apparent injustice that happens in the world if there is an almighty God who is all-powerful and who is just and who is a just God? So how do you explain the apparent injustice of the world? What about the existence of evil in the world? So there are various such things which a logical mind, which comes before the logical mind, and which shows that an idea of a personal God who sits and controls, who is there out there somewhere, apart from the universe, and who controls the workings of the universe, is illogical. Instead, the scientist, as the modern science is finding out, there are impersonal laws which work in all aspects of nature. Whether it is in biology, whether it is in astronomy, whether it is in chemistry, physics, astrophysics, whatever branch of science that you take, wherever you examine nature, wherever you probe into the secrets of nature, you will find that there are laws which work. The whole nature works on the basis of laws. So this being said, we must understand that the perversity of the God idea which we find today, the idea of a personal God whom we have to pray and whom we have to appease and so on and so forth, this was not the ancient idea of deity. This was not the ancient idea of God. Their idea of God, the idea of God of the ancient sages, was not to be found in the temple. It was not to be found in any one particular person or a set of people. It was not to be found in any object outside. But they said that this is an infinite principle, an impersonal infinite principle which pervades all, which is in all, and which is therefore the whole universe is an expression of the one divine, the one God. Let us consider a couple of verses from the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and even from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and see what Krishna says about this. He says in the 13th chapter, I will read a few verses. It is that which has no beginning, even the supreme Brahma, and of which it cannot be said that it is either being or non-being. It has hands and feet in all directions, eyes, heads, mouths and ears in every direction. It is immanent in the world, possessing the vast whole. Itself without organs, it is reflected by all the senses and faculties. Unattached, yet supporting all. Without qualities, yet the witness of them all. It is within and without all creatures, animate and inanimate. It is inconceivable because of its subtlety, and although near, it is afar off. although undivided, it appeareth as divided among creatures, and while it sustains existing things, it is also known to be their destroyer and creator. It is the light of all lights, and is to be declared to be beyond all darkness. It is wisdom itself, the object of wisdom, and that which is to be attained by wisdom. In the hearts of all, it ever presideth. Very important verse in the Bhagavad Gita, which where Krishna gives the idea of what is deity, what is divinity, where is it, where do we find it. He has answered all those questions in this few verses. And this oneself, you may say, because as Krishna says, it is in the hearts of all beings, whether animate or inanimate. There is only one spirit that shines in the smallest of the atoms, as well as the greatest of the sun that we see. So the life, the spirit, the consciousness in each proceeds from this one source. And this is synonymous and one with what is called as law. God and law are not two different things. God is law and law is God. And this law is the moral order of the universe. There is a moral order in the universe. We were mentioning of the contemporary scientists the scientists of today who intuit that there is something beyond the mechanical workings of nature. One of them is David Bohm, and he says that there is an implicate order in the universe. The world, the universe, the cosmos is not chaos. It doesn't work haphazardly. There is a definite, regular, implicate order in the universe. Very intuitive scientist. This is what Guru Nanak called as the hukum. The hukum is law, order, or the moral order of the universe. And when we study the ancient scriptures, what we find is law and God are not seen as two different things, but law is God. And this law is ever active, it is immutable, and it is not again any person or a being, but an impersonal law which works. And we will consider a very nice explanation given by Buddha, Lord Buddha, where he speaks about this. He says that there is no use praying to some god. There is no use sacrificing to a god, expecting some benefit for yourself, because there is no such god who can give you something which you haven't earned, which you haven't deserved. Look at what he says. He says, pray not, the darkness will not brighten. Ask not from the silence, for it cannot speak. Vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers, sisters, seek not from the helpless gods by gift and hymn, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruits and cakes. Within yourself deliverance must be sought. Each man his prison makes. Within yourself deliverance must be sought. That is what he says. He positively discourages any kind of rituals or praying for this god or that god, and he says that it is your own actions which will bear fruit and which will bring to you happiness or sorrow. And this is the working of the law. And no god or no power in the universe exists which can confer upon you any benefits which you do not deserve. So, if we just contrast the idea of the moral order of the universe, where justice prevails, and where anything that we do will bear its fruit, and we will have to take the responsibility of it. If we take this idea and juxtapose it with an idea of some God who sits there and confers boon upon us and gives us something based on our petition to such a God, we find that what is logical and what is philosophical is this idea of a moral order in the universe. For example, take the case of a criminal who commits a murder, and how much pain and sorrow is caused, and how much trouble and suffering is caused to the victim and the victim's family. Now, if one who commits such a crime is able to escape the consequences of his action just by doing some prayer or offering some performing some rituals or offering something to a God, where is the logic of it? Where is the justice of it? Is it in any way just? Can a logical thinking mind accept any such brutal injustice? Impossible. Just like modern science finds that there are laws which are working in all aspects of nature, so also in the circumstances, the fortunes and misfortunes of our life, it is law that works. It is law that works. And this law, being impersonal, does not have ears to listen to our prayers and listen to our petitions. And like we found the idea of God mentioned by Krishna, which is all beings are expressions of that, and all beings are expressions of the one and the same. So underlying all this is a unity of life. There is interconnectedness, and this being the case, it is our whole universe is like a pond filled with water. In its normal state, it is in absolute harmony, calm and undisturbed. Just drop one small pebble at any part of the pond, and ripples are created. And is the ripple, is the disturbance just localized to the point where the disturbance was created, where the pebble was dropped? No, the ripples spread across, and it affects the whole of the pond. It affects the whole of the pond. Every single particle in the pond is disturbed. Our universe, with all the beings, with all the humans and other beings, visible and invisible, is like this pond. Any disturbance created at any point in this whole universe has a far-reaching effect on all the other beings, near and far. And what happens when ripples are created in the pond? The ripples go to the end of the pond, and then they converge back into the pond, to the point where the disturbance was created. Similarly also, when we act, when we speak, when we think, what happens in the deepest recesses of our mind, everything has an effect on the universe. And the consequences of this comes back upon us. We will have to face the effect that it produces, effect of our thoughts, words and actions. This is exactly what Buddha says, where he says, don't think praying or doing this or that ritual will help you, but it is your own thoughts, your own words, your own deeds, which is creating your future for you. There is nobody else who compels. There is nobody else who is pushing you. There is nobody else who is pulling you. This basic idea must be understood. This idea of interconnectedness, which again we find in the Gita, if we turn to chapter 13, where Krishna says, as a single sun illuminates the whole world, even so does the one spirit illumine everybody. So our at a very fundamental level, we are all interconnectedness. We are all interconnected. And what we do affects all other beings. And even he says the same in another chapter, which of course we can consider later. So this was their idea of God. This was the idea of God and law among the ancients. And just a study of our ancient scriptures will clarify these ideas, will show us that what we are following today is a very distorted and perverted idea of God and nature and law. Whereas clearly Krishna and in the Upanishads and in all the other holy scriptures of the world, if we dive deep into it, we will find that this is the idea mentioned. So, moving further, if everything that we speak, think and do have a profound effect on not only ourselves but upon all other beings, then we have a responsibility towards them. This is what Buddha says. Lord Buddha says in the very first verse of the Dhammapada, when he says, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. All that we are is founded on our thoughts and formed of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain pursues him as the wheel of the wagon follows the hoof of the ox that draws it. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. All that we are is founded on our thoughts and formed of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness pursues him like his own shadow that never leaves him. For Lord Buddha to say this, it is based on this fact in nature that we are all interconnected. Great teachers like Buddha and others, their teachings are all based on facts in nature, the ethics that they ask us to follow, the way of life that they show, are all based on scientific facts of nature and not sentimental statements. So this has to be understood. So what Lord Buddha says here is that all the circumstances of your life is your own making. Do you feel that your life is full of sorrow? Do you feel it is full of troubles? Then don't blame any God. Don't blame any other person. Because you have set causes in the far past which is bearing the fruit. Which is bearing fruit. And the law is such that it just restores the harmony. It is not the law which is punishing you. It is not the law which is rewarding you. The law of karma, as he calls, karma means action. This law of karma is not what will punish you or reward you. It is yourself who either work according to the law and then bring about beneficent effects to all, or you work antagonistic to it and bring about pain and suffering. The law just restores the harmony. So, cause and effect. Do we not find cause and effect in wherever you see anything that happens will have a prior cause? For a plant to grow, a seed must be sown. It does not just come out of nothing. And there is a relationship between what is the kind of seed that you sow and what is the plant that grows. If you, for example, if you sow pepper seed, you cannot expect jasmine flowers. If you sow pepper seed, pepper plant will come. If you sow rose seeds, then rose plant will come. So cause and effect always have relationship. And without cause, there can be no effect. Similarly, in our life, everything that we are facing, our opportunities, our fortunes and misfortunes, the pain that we find, the happiness that comes to us, the opportunities that we find in life, and the good things that happen to us, as well as the apparent bad things, everything has a prior cause. Nothing can come accidentally. There is no accidents in the universe. Everything happens according to law. And let's read a few more verses from Lord Buddha's teachings, which very nicely illustrates this idea of personal responsibility for our life. He speaks about this law, the moral order of the universe. He says, before beginning and without an end, as space eternal and as surety sure, is fixed a power divine which moves to good. Only its laws endure. Only its laws endure. And then he says, this is its work upon the things you see. The unseen things are more. Men's hearts and minds, the thoughts of peoples, their ways and wills, these two the great law binds. And look at these verses, which are very, 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 very nice verses, where he says that this law is not something that you need to pray to. This law is not something that you need to do some rituals and appease. What is this law? He explains this law when he says, it sees everywhere and marks all. Do right, it recompenses. Do one wrong, and equal retribution must be made, though dharma tarry long. It knows not wrath nor pardon. Utter true its measures be, its faultless balance weighs. Times are as naught, tomorrow it will judge, or after many days. By this, the slayer's knife did stab himself. The unjust judge has lost his own defender. The false tongue dooms its lie. The creeping thief and spoiler rob to render. Such is the law which moves to righteousness, which none at last can turn aside or stay. The heart of it is love, the end of it is peace, and consummation sweet, obey. So, this is the ancient view of life, which is based on very scientific understanding of the workings of nature. And what we need today is going back and understanding this loss of life. Look at an athlete. For an athlete to succeed and perform well, he has to understand the laws of health, the laws of hygiene, how to exercise, and what is the best way to train himself, isn't it? He understands the science behind his profession. So also in the case of an architect, he has to understand the design, the strength of materials, and the various laws of design, such that the structure is strong, and so on and so forth. And in the case of a musician also, he understands the science behind his instrument, the science behind music itself. So if this is the case in all aspects of life, then why do we not understand that life itself has a science behind it? And this law of life, this science of life, has to be understood, which is given so in such simple language if we just study the ancient scriptures. This being the ideas about, just a few ideas about what is God, what is law, and how God and law are not two different things but one and the same. Where do we find this divinity? The hint was already given when we studied Krishna's teachings. You find it within yourself. There is no other way, there is no other door open to man to find divinity except through his own consciousness. Because man himself is an expression, a copy or a reflection of the highest power that is there. And in the 10th chapter or probably in the 11th chapter of the Gita, Krishna describes by way of example his different manifestations in nature. Because as we began our talk today with the idea that there is only one spirit, there is only one God which is reflecting in all beings, and after describing just a few manifestations by way of example to Arjuna, Krishna says that I am the ego which is seated in the hearts of all beings. So for man to find divinity, he has to seek it within himself. This is the constant cry of Upanishads, that Tattvamasi, you are that, you are in no way different from the highest power, the highest divinity that is there in the universe, is yourself. It is there within yourself, and this is what has to be understood. And if the great divine power is there within all of us, then what is it that stops us from why are we not able to understand it? Why are we not able to perceive the divinity within ourselves? Why are we not able to perceive the moral order of the universe, which is an expression of the unity of life? It is because, as Guru Nanak Dev says, that we are all Manmukhi and not Gurumukhi. That is, we have completely turned our mind, our attention from our real nature, and we have put complete attention on the worldly affairs, the earthly affairs, the taking care of the body which is temporary, and taking care of the name and the form which is there for just a few years and then goes away. Whereas what one has to do is to transform by taking the knowledge which is given by the teachers, transform our view of life, and from being Manmukhi become Gurumukhi. That is, put our mind, put our attention, and put our attention on that part of our nature which is divine. It is there within all of us, it is there within each one of us, and we hear it in that still small voice of conscience. That is what has to be heeded, and this is what this is the task that each one of us have to accomplish. In the ICS Unveiled study on Sunday mornings, we just a few classes before, we studied this very nice expression called as the hermetic veil. Hermetic veil refers to a particular veil, where veil is a covering which is there in the disciple's heart, and unless he removes that veil, he is not able to see the face of the true teacher. This is the condition in which we are all this is the common condition of all of us, that though there is the source of the universe, as Krishna says, is within us, we are not able to recognize because there is a hermetic veil in us. And this veil is the sense of separateness. This veil is the sense of separateness, which is the root of all problems in man's life. As as it is called in the Buddhist philosophy, it is Attavada. Attavada is the sense that I am separate from you and I am separate from God. So this separation has to be destroyed. This sense of separateness has to be removed by taking knowledge. Because what has to be trained in us, what has to be changed in us, is not our, not what we eat, not what we drink, not what we wear, and so on, but what we think, what we feel, what are our thoughts. Those are the most profound things. And these thoughts and feelings, if they are based on wrong ideas of life, then we will perform wrong actions, we will speak wrong things and put ourselves in grief. Whereas if we take knowledge and make this knowledge as the basis of our thought and action, then we become from outward going manmukhis to we gradually transform ourselves into gurumukhis.